pegaso. Como Cantinflas.
Ya es todo, ¿no?
Ah, sí.
Gracias.
Primero que todo, muchísimas gracias por bringing such an amazing movie and story to life.
Thank you.
It really has made my week so far.
Thank you.
Sure.
And it's only Sunday. I have a whole week to go.
One thing that I told my colleagues here is, like, it definitely got me from kissing frogs to going and searching for now.
Going deep sea fishing. Sashimi has another meaning now.
Yeah,
there are plenty of fish in the sea.
There are plenty.
Okay, I can't help myself. You have an amazing imagination.
Thank you.
Overlooking one particular scene, the whole thing is just amazing to watch.
Thank you very much. Well, it's a movie done... impossible to do this movie without loving it profoundly, you know, and believing in it profoundly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some movies require craft, some movies require faith, and some movies require craft and faith, and this is one of those.
So I read that you financed the design of the creature yourself.
Yes.
Why was that? When they did the studio, are they more open? They don't want to do like...
No, I wanted, first of all, I wanted, when you pitch the story or you show the story to a studio, you needed to show the creature. Because mm-hmm. when you say, look, they're going to get it on, they're going to go, what is it going to look like? You know, and then you go, hubba hubba. And they go, oh, well, okay, we can see that happening, you know?
Mm-hmm. Where did the idea came from?
Well, it, many, many places, because when I was a kid, I saw Creature from the Black Lagoon at age 6, and I saw sort of the beginnings of the love story there, and it ended bad for the couple. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't end up happily ever after, and I thought, that's unfair, you know? The creature was more interesting than the guys that were in the boat, mm-hmm. you know? And I thought that, and then really the last decade or so for me, as an immigrant, you feel the tension in the air about division, you know? And it's now very manifest, but it's been brewing for decades, really, if not more. And it's because I think... right now we are forgetting about just immigration. We are in a place in our culture where hatred and fear are main parts of the discourse, you know, of every day. So we wake up to the worst news about the worst possible things in the world, you know, in the intimate place of our work, in the political arena, in the religious arena, massacres here, you know, and I realize as a storyteller that we've come to the point in which if we have the inception of an ideology, we can make anyone believe anything about anyone. You know, like we are at a point in which we reduce people to one word. It can be immigrant, it can be about the race, it can be about religion, mm-hmm. and we make them invisible. We make them silent. And we can beat them, kill them, deport them, arrest them, with complete insensitivity to our souls, you know? Mm-hmm. The ideologies are the only thing that allows a human being to beat another human being. Mm-hmm. Without that, you can't. Because at the end of the day, I think that a lot of people are normal human beings, but if you insert the ideology, most people can.
En cada película se busca la mejor historia, la película de tu vida. Uh-huh. ¿Cómo es esa visión que tú tienes, si me lo pudieras decir en español?
Sí, no, lo que pasa es que hay que hablar de las inquietudes que tienes. Uh-huh. Y en este caso la inquietud que tengo es la manera en que tratamos al otro, entre comillas. Uh-huh. ¿Sí? En que nos damos permiso para nulificar al otro, ¿no? Que sea lo que sea, ¿eh? No hablo nomás de una cosa. En general, el discurso global está muy crispado, lleno de odio. And to complement in English, to say this in English, what happens is the social discourse right now, if you are, how would I put it, cynical, if you're a cynic and you say, If I tell you right now here, I'm 53 and I do not believe in love, you go, wow, this guy is very sophisticated, you know? But if I tell you I'm 53 and I believe in love, you go, how naive, you know? And I think that that's a shame. Because I do think that the two forces that shape human behavior and the world is fear and love. But fear begets hatred. There's no hatred without fear. You can only hate what you don't understand.
And that's pretty much us. I think, like, yeah, your movie, it creates a safe space for, like, us, the others.
Yeah.
It's the otherization.
Yeah.
So I feel like at the end of the day, I relate with the monsters more,
yeah,
than with the cast.
Yeah.
So for this film, you include love and monsters in one, like, platform. So I wanted to know a little bit more about, like, those two interchanging of love and monstrosity.
Well, what I think is more than monstrosity is difference.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that monsters in movies, for me, at a very young age, became figures of spiritual recognition. Mm-hmm. Why? Because monsters are the embodiment of imperfection. They walk in and they don't pretend to be perfect. They can't. They're so different. So they are unapologetic about their imperfection. And I think that the essence of love is to know and embrace imperfection. And the essence of fear is to seek control and perfection. So look at the bad guy in the movie, the antagonist, seeks complete control with the woman he's married to, the woman that works for him, his environment, the way he is, his own persona, you know, it's all control. And it's impossible. Nobody is perfect. Everybody's imperfect. And monsters are an embodiment of compassion and understanding. And look, this is who I am. What am I going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And that's what I think that's where we all breathe. Not in the black or the white, we breathe in the gray. You know? We exist in the gray. It's a matter of degrees. Everybody is 10%, 20%, 30% wrong and bad and an asshole every day. Of course we are. We're not creatures of imagination, but that doesn't mean we're all asshole. 70% of the time we're good. If you are 70% of the time an asshole, then you are an asshole. I'm sorry to say. You know, but that's a matter of degrees, but that's gray. That's still gray. I think that we the way we communicate socially now is so black or white, you know? And I think is permeating, that discourse of hatred is permeating every arena. And I wanted to say, can we look at each other with love rather than fear? You know, can we look at each other with, look at the creature. Each character looks at it in a different way. For the antagonist, is a filthy thing that came from South America. You know,
mm-hmm.
For the scientist, is a miracle of nature, and is the embodiment of everything that's good in his science. For Giles, is a god from the river that is gonna give him hair. For Eliza, is the recognition of her essence and her loneliness that she was not aware of until she met him.
It adapts to every character.
Well, it's because the way you see somebody is,
yeah,
the way that look. I don't know how to explain this, except the way it is in the movie, I guess. The greatest act of love is seeing. When you see somebody in its entirety, in its complexity, in the good and the bad, and you love that person, that's the greatest act of love. And that's why she says, every time he sees me, I mean, and he doesn't know I'm incomplete, you know? And the way... And what shares that loving gaze is cinema. Movies see. And to me, that's why love and cinema are one and the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the movie is a love letter to love and love letter to cinema. I've said it and I mean it, you know?
In your earlier answer where you mentioned that people are invisible and silent, is that what draw you to make the two main characters mute?
Yeah, but also because love makes you speechless. You know, you can't talk about love. You can talk about love, I mean, but it doesn't really mean. Love is, I'm absolutely, and I don't mean just romantic love. I don't mean we should all go out and dance together. I mean, is mother-son, father-son, daughter-mother, sister-to-sister, brother-to-brother. every love heals. You know, there's a very, I mean, it's gonna sound like a Chinese cookie thing, but if you are in great need, give. Yeah. If you are in great need, give. The moment you give, you're super rich. Mm-hmm. You're super rich, and it's true. And in love, you don't need anything. If you've ever been in love, even for 5 minutes, requited or unrequited, when you're in love, you don't need anything else. Nothing. You don't know how much you have in the bank. You don't know how much your suit costs. You don't know what your car is. You don't care. You're in love. And it heals. And it can be in love with your family. It can be in love. But it is really healing. And I wanted to talk about it in a fairy tale. Because fairy tales are the only way right now I feel that we can communicate without arguing.
But this is an adult fairy tale, and inclusion of, you're talking about love and inclusion of sex as well, and female sexuality that we usually see in movies just to serve some kind of purpose, or for men to see a woman doing something that for us is like sexy or something, but to portray female sexuality and this couple having sex, and for people is kind of uncomfortable to watch. So we can accept the love of a Hallmark card, but when we see people really expressing that love for us, it's kind of uncomfortable. Yeah. What does say about us?
A simple thing like masturbation, which everybody has practice with, everybody. Most people, it doesn't show on the screen. And female sexuality scares men. Doesn't scare women, you know, scares men. Because the worst thing you can do to a gender is to put it in a pedestal and say, because that's not human. Who the fuck can survive in a pedestal? You know, I need to go to the bathroom. No, stay in your pedestal. Hey, I need to lay down. No, stay in your pedestal. It's the same thing. You put somebody in a pedestal to hate them. And that's part of the sexual politics. The only sexual act that I think is creepy in the movie is the one between Barbie and Ken, when he's trying to dominate her and keep her quiet, you know? That's the only creepy thing. The rest of the sexual things in the movie are seen with complete naturality. All of them. And none of them is perverse. None of them is hoo-hoo-hoo. It's, you know, she wakes up, she boils eggs, she masturbates, she shines her shoes. And then it goes to work. That's a perfectly acceptable routine, you know. Yeah. And by the way, the way her and the river elemental god get it together, get it on, is done also in the same incredibly beautiful, natural. There's no perverse gaze to the act. I'm not like hoo hoo. I go, She closes the curtain, and you know what's going to happen. What is beautiful is that they talk about it the next day. That makes it natural.
Yeah.
You know why it makes it natural? Because you go to your best your buddy girlfriend. And say, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you go, how was it? Who?
Yeah.
You know, you talk about it. So that's what makes it natural.
Well, I was going to ask, was it difficult to cast that as Sally's role? Because
I wrote it for her. I wrote it for her from the beginning. I wrote it for her because I knew I didn't, in this Beauty and the Beast story, I didn't want Beauty to be a princess. I wanted her to be a woman, a normal person that was extraordinarily beautiful in her own way, but not a perfume model commercial girl, you know, that pretends to be a cleaner of toilets, you know. I wanted to say, look, there's beauty in all our faces, you know, and there's luminosity in all the faces if you gaze them properly. And she's an extraordinary actress. She's completely luminous, magical. The movie is the mixture of the extraordinary and the ordinary. And she has those qualities. You can believe Sally Hawkins is sitting next to you in the bus. Of course. And you can believe she cleans toilets in that facility, of course. But then you look at her sustainedly in the movie, and she's utterly magical and utterly gorgeous, you know? And that, to me, is a miracle. So I wrote it for her, specifically.
Now, the movies with Fox Searchlight, I think it's probably the only, well, one of the few studios you can do this kind of movie with, because some studios will look at you like, really? You're going to make this movie? Because it's such a mix of genres. It's so independent.
Yeah.
Right? Where was that they always the...
I think that the movies I do are not easy to pitch. You know, they're always difficult, but that's fine. You know, look, I do what I do, and I've been doing it for 25 years. And all those 25 years led me to this movie. And I went to one studio and one studio only, and that was Searchlight, because Alejandro told me he had such a great time with Birdman. He said, this is the place you gotta go. And I went. But that's why I had the model.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I had the drawings of the sets, the apartment, the lab. I wanted to show them how the movie was going to look.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I had a piece of the screenplay and a complete beat sheet of the entire structure. And then the conversation was, how much? And they said 19.5.
Did they want to scratch something at one point or not? Or did
no.
they just
they give you complete
on?
Freedom, right?
Yeah.
From what I hear
yeah.
from Social Life?
Absolute freedom.
So
100%. I mean, I've been free since 1997.
Mm-hmm.
After Mimic, I've been free completely. Nobody has ever made me do nothing in my life. But I work best at complete freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And this was complete freedom.
So it's been 20 years of your love affair with your movies.
Yes.
What about this movie that sets it apart from the other ones that you've done?
Vitality. The movie is the most vital movie I've made. All my other movies have a sadness and a sense of loss that is unbearable almost sometimes. With Pan's Labyrinth, it destroys me because it's such a tragic and beautiful but painful story, you know, but it's almost like a demolition derby. This movie has vitality. I mean, the movie makes you believe in love in a way, at least to me, you know, and it fills you with... I wanted it to be like a song. I wanted you to see the movie and come out humming the movie. Not the song, not the music, but...
Or crying.
But in a way, like when...
Yeah.
I wanted... Look, when you're driving in a freeway and a great love song comes in the radio and you
yeah.
pump it to full
yeah.
volume and you sing with it and then the song ends and you go, yeah! That's what I wanted the movie to have. You know, and you cry, but there's a beauty... I mean, look, there's no beauty in the world almost at all. Everything's prepackaged, calculated, artificial, corporate. That I wanted the movie to have its own beauty, and for that beauty to be vital and to be life-affirming, you know?
And talking about that music, the score was on point with the visuals. Oh my God, I felt every
unbelievable.
Single moment.
Yeah, yeah.
How did you find that synergy with Alexander?
You know, we started, we've done two projects together. We did Rise of the Guardians, the animated movie, and we did Troll Hunters. He did the themes. And I took him to a sashimi restaurant. And I said, there's this movie I'm going to do. I took him there like in 2013 or 2014. And I said, I want you to do the score. And he said, let's see the movie. You know, he didn't say, yes. He said, let's see the movie. And then I started his contract negotiation. And we were ready, and he said, I just want to see the movie. And then I showed him the movie without score. And he finished, and he said, it's your best movie. I love it. I want to do the score. And we always said, let's make it a very French score,
mm-hmm.
you know, like Georges de la Rue, you know, with the little accordion and the whistling and the very vital energy, you know, and he did a masterpiece of score.
For many outsiders and outcasts, cinema is a way for, like, escape, you know, like, you go, you watch a movie, and you escape for a moment, and I noticed that Elisa, she's always watching movies, and she lives above a movie theater, so I wanted to know if that was, like, your tribute meta of
yeah.
putting, like, a movie within a movie.
Well, more than a meta, it's a sincere belief. Movies have saved my life several times in my biography. Like, really points in which I don't know what the world is about, and a movie comes on TV, or I go to a theater and I see a movie, and I come out with tears streaming down my face, and I say, life is good, You know, and that has not happened only with great movies. It happens with small movies, with a Mexican melodrama with Pedro Infante. It can happen with a great musical. It can happen with Brazil, Terry Gilliam. But that's cinema, not great cinema, any cinema. You know, when I was a kid, we used to go to the theater to see what was playing. Vamos al cine a ver qué están dando. And you entered, you went into the cinema. You didn't know what the fucking movie started. We're gonna eat and then go to, and you entered at 3:15 and the movie was 15 minutes to the ending. It ended and then you stayed until it started again. I understand it. And that, I didn't want to make an homage to great cinema. That's why it's not meta. If it was meta, the camera would go through the floor and we see Citizen Kane or Singing in the Rain or a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. But what I want to say is, no. Cinema saves your life no matter how humble cinema is sometimes, you know? So it is the idea that, and it's also, she has no voice, right? Mm-hmm. So I need to tell you how she thinks, by how she looks, how she acts, how she behaves, but also by what she's made of. She dreams of water. She eats foods that are processed in water, boiled. Yeah. She pleasures herself in water. And she, all day long, she's listening to cinema. Through the floorboards. All day long, all night. Because it says all day and all night, you know? All day long, all night long, she goes to sleep with the cinema. She has to put her little things on the... on her head, you know, to go to sleep because the movie is playing all day. And that tells you how her mind works. She sees a dancing number. She comes out and tries the tap dance. You know, she dances with her friend in the sofa. That's who she is, you know.
Guillermo, the journalist in me has to ask you this because I really want to have the record straight when it comes to this short, the space between us. It's just... is it just a coincidence? Is something that bothers you? Is something that...
No. When it came to light, look, the chronology we have is so easy. Started in 2012, was paying for development 2013, 2014. 2014, we pitched it to Searchlight. I've done two movies with Amphibian Man in cylinders in secret government facilities, Hellboy 1 and Hellboy 2. Mm-hmm. So I'm a guy with... his own imagination. I've never, every time I am influenced by something, I either acquire it or acknowledge it. In 2011, Daniel Krauss told me the idea of the janitor, blah, 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 and I bought it from him. I bought it from him in 2011 through a contract. So, you know, that's it. I mean, I'm me. In fantasy, you walk the line. Somebody else mentioned a novel called Mrs. Caliban, about a woman that falls in love with a reptilian, amphibian creature. I go, God bless. And I'm sure there's... another person mentioned a Russian movie called The Amphibian Man, about an amphibian man that falls in love with a woman. I go, God bless. What am I going to do?
¿Cómo es el premio especial a Iñárritu que le dieron el Oscar?
Hermoso porque no solo está empujando tecnología, sino temática y arte. In narrativa.
Guillermo, the scratches on Elisa's neck. Gills?
Yeah, that came from Sally's story.
Oh.
Sally was writing a story about a woman that turns into a fish.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And I said I had the idea that they jumped in the water and he carried her, and that's it. And then Sally said to me, "I'm writing a story about a woman that turns into a fish, and she has scars, and they turn out to be gills." And I said, "That's the ending of the movie."
Well, I knew when I saw them early on, I was like, oh, gills.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.